Hello, this is Jack and
Tika,
and we are discussing the penultimate episode of Lovecraft Country.
Rewind 1921.
And it's all about Tulsa and going back to the past.
Back to the future, back to the past, whatever.
Back to the past, yes, somewhere in time.
Yeah.
Montrose, Tick and Letty's excellent adventure.
Yeah, so now we're gonna get into it right now.
We're going to get into it right now.
This episode was quite
intense.
It was an intense episode. I mean, the thing is that there were no necessarily monsters.
Well, there was lots of human monsters.
It was kind of ironic. Not ironic, but maybe the Alanis Morissette version of ironic, because I had just written a piece about this up on Public Intellectuals about the Reconstruction era and Jim Crow, and people who seem to be confused about this period of Black America, as I'm more than the fourth generation, but fourth generation Angeleno, that's Los Angeles, and my family has been in the United States since the 1700s on paper. So I know a lot about African-American history, because also we were in the same spot, which a lot of people did not have the privilege of being. We were in the same spot in Louisiana. And to kind of talk about this period that was the end of Reconstruction, or the beginning of Jim Crow, I think a lot of people feel that this period was during Jim Crow, like this period of Black people owning hotels and Black people owning businesses and Black people having agency. I think a lot of people confuse it and think this happened during Jim Crow, not understanding that we were segregated in Jim Crow and all this stuff was burned down.
Well, there was this huge influx of money. To review, Tulsa is in Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1907, Oklahoma becomes a state. But you have to remember, in 1899, they had the last great land rush. And very, very soon after that, not only did they take the land, they got the mineral rights as well. Oklahoma was a huge oil boom. And in these boom economies, sometimes they don't care what race you are. Can you work? And a lot of African Americans struck gold, black gold. Or they may have done the thing that usually works even better, is to supply the people that are the wildcats out there drilling for oil. So in Tulsa, you had this massive influence of money. We like to think these days of Oklahoma as a poor state, but it was rich. And that richness allowed the development of this community, Greenwood. And it allowed it to have hotels and theaters and all sorts of shops. So this was born at the end of a period in which African Americans had a lot more rights, had a lot more control, and they also had this massive influx of money. I don't think people remember that. They're still thinking, oh, it's south of the Mason-Dixon line. It must be poor. No. As you pointed out, this was a rich community.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing, that there was a very strong Black middle class during Reconstruction. Black people could go to Harvard University, not trying to say that, oh, if it's a white university, it's a better university, but saying that we were integrated, very well integrated into society during Reconstruction. We were pretty integrated. You know, there were Black businesses, there were Black doctors, there were quite a few Black doctors, and more Black doctors during that period, more Black medical schools during that period than after, like in the 40s and 50s, and even now. Percentage of Black doctors and things like that. And they even talked about this in the episode of what they did to the Black doctor, the first surgeon.
The highly accomplished one.
Yeah, the highly accomplished surgeon. And I think that people kind of like, when, you know, people go, oh, our ancestors' wildest dreams. Well, you clearly don't understand what your ancestors were doing, because there's a time between our enslavement, between Black people's enslavement and Jim Crow, that was a very productive time. And the reason, another reason I'm going to kind of, the reason I'm kind of jumping into that is because I think about the Harlem Renaissance, and I think about, and we're kind of jumping around here, but we're going to go to the father, Montrose.
Yes.
And they go back in time, and clearly Montrose was always gay, and he was always, you know, he was always gay, and there was, it was, it, in the beginning, it was kind of like, oh, he was hidden gay, and he was trying to hide
in
it.
In the closet.
In the closet. But clearly, he was doing things that weren't so closety, and his father was beating him because he had a flower in his hair. He had a friend.
Every once in a while, you know, the closet door is left open.
Yeah.
And people see what's inside. And what happened, his dad caught him in several situations. And in fact, he started to realize how risky it is, such that his friend, that they, well, obviously they're out to each other, though still yeah. kind of closeted. He tells him, sorry, we cannot meet anymore. Why? Because his dad is beating him.
And I think the thing that's interesting for me is, while I understand we want to go back in time, and it wouldn't have been, as in some circles, it would not have been acceptable to be homosexual, to be bisexual, as I feel that some people have misinterpreted the Black economy during Reconstruction, because I know about the Harlem Renaissance and County Cohen and Langston Hughes, and they were pretty openly gay. And this, like you said, Tulsa at this time was a sophisticated Black city. This wasn't some hick town. So you're saying that Black people who had surgeons, who had, you know, authors, who had a Wall Street, you're telling me that they would be beating you because you were gay, when there are openly gay people in W.E. Du Bois's circle? Mm-hmm. There's, I'm now starting to think that people are being a little bit influenced by kind of a heterosexist, white supremacist lens of what Black America was during that period. Maybe during, like later on during the 50s and Jim Crow, but during that period, I don't know.
A lot of doors closed in that period. I'm trying to remember if it was the celluloid closet or another documentary or description of this. But while homosexuality was not accepted, it wasn't rooted out. I'm trying to remember who it was. It might have been Eisenhower, who was informed that one of his secretaries, who is a wave in the Navy, was a lesbian. And he called her in, and she said, yes, I am. And he said, well, you're fired. And then all these other ones said, well, you're going to have to fire me, too. It was there, and you even saw it in, Berlin during the 20s, but after Paris was liberated, it really was liberated. They had open clubs where men were dancing with one another and romancing. So to say that this was always a period of repression, the repression was stronger in certain times and a lot looser and possibly even accepting in other times. And the 50s was a particularly repressive period where they went after different ethnicities. They tightened the screws on the African-American community and the gay community and the Native American communities. They continued with their policy of killing the Indian to save the child.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so, I guess that's my problem I'm having with this. Of course, it's fiction. And so from you know, it being fiction, we have to understand it from that perspective. But I'm having a little bit of a problem with this. Oh, you know, on one hand, we had these, you know, glamorous Black people that, you know, that were well-read, had all these beautiful things. But at the same time, they were homophobic. Like, that homophobic? I mean, I'm not saying some people maybe, But everybody?
Yeah.
Like, everybody?
Well,
really?
Probably would have been more working class.
That's what I'm saying. It didn't fit the class that he was in. Mm. W.E. Du Bois knew that his daughter married a gay man. They had a whole conversation about it. He got divorced. I mean, you know, the amount of gay, openly gay men in the arts, in that world, in upper middle class, black world, and even, I'll say, even dare I say now, in Los Angeles, there are a lot of gay, out gay people. Not maybe necessarily out, but there is, I have to say, an equal amount in the arts, politics, writing, literature world. There is an equal amount of gay people and straight people. That's like the automatic truth. I can't see that being so different in 1919. I can't see it being that different. But, you know.
Well, once again, that's the upper middle class community. Are you saying that these folks were upper middle class? They definitely appear to be middle class.
Yeah, but they had to put it this way. It's 1921. You're black. Not just this. You have cars. Mm-hmm. You have a car. You have fancy clothes. You have a telephone. That was another thing. They had a telephone.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. Once again, we're dealing with a fictional narrative.
Yes.
They're going to construct this. Within every group, you're going to have some people that are a lot more accepting and some people that are just...
Yeah, but I guess my challenge is that I feel they're not making it seem like the father was unreasonable. Seems like I think people are going to see this and think it's the whole community. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, black people are not accepting of gay people. I think that's what they're trying. That is what the impression people will get. And I think mm-hmm. that's a wrong impression. It'd be fine if they were just like, his father was completely, you know, off the chain. This is not typical. I don't think that's fine.
Yeah.
But to me, I think because people are so kind of closed-minded in how they think of the black experience, that I feel this could be a problem. And because I don't think it's true. And I think this was an individual, it's a case-by-case basis. I think some people would be unhappy, some people, I don't know. I was not mm-hmm. there. I'm simply going, you know, everybody's going back in history and interpreting things the way they want to interpret things.
Through their own lens.
But, you know, let's kind of get back to the story. We are, you know, they go back in time because D actually, you know, her spell has become worse. Like, Topsy...
The spell runs a course, and Topsy and was it Topsy and Bopsy?
Topsy and Bopsy and something like that.
They've inhabited her body, and they're turning her into them. And you can see that when we last see the episode, she's lying in bed, but it's Dee. And when we revisit her again, when Christina comes to talk about it, she's turning into the lighter colored one. I don't know.
She's turning into one of the creatures. Topsy, I went to Topsy and Bopsy. And I'll tell you something. Something very strange, them going to Christine to help. I wonder if there was this, a weird, like, Christina is some kind of representative of white feminism. I mean, that subtext, mm-hmm. I almost feel like that. Like, in this story, she's kind of representing, like, white feminism coming in, and, like, other ones, like, you know, she's trying to help you. Don't you see she's trying to help us? And this black man is, I don't know if that's happening. And like I said, I'm not the kind of person that thinks, like, oh, black men are horrible, whatever. I'm not of that school of pathologizing black men. But I'm saying, for the writers, are they trying to make, or, like I said, you know, or judging anybody anyway, but are they trying to say that Christina is a representation of white feminism within this context? Because it keeps coming off that way to me.
Well, you like that whole woke commentary.
Yeah.
That, and I don't know if you want to bring that up at this point.
The commentary, we're going to talk about Bill Burr. I'll say this. I'm not really a fan of necessarily of white men critiquing white women in regards mm-hmm. to who's more racist, who's more horrible. I don't feel like it's white men's place to necessarily mm-hmm. check white women on that. But it was an interesting commentary because, you know, I had friends kind of go like, you know, yes, how did, you know, white women kind of come into this how did white women come into, you know, being the beneficiaries? And this is like not even an opinion, this is fact, but white women do benefit from affirmative action more so than any other ethnic group. White women benefit. But to kind of put everything on them, it's kind of a tool of sexism because I feel that within the whole like racism, things like that, white women, yes, they participated. But for me, I seem to think that white women are getting a lot more heat than white men.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's fair. So me saying, I wonder if Christine is supposed to represent white feminism isn't necessarily a slam on white women. It's me wondering what the writers are doing with her, because she doesn't necessarily seem like a bad character, but I could see her being interpreted that way, and I'm wondering what's going to happen at the end.
Well, she's... We're back to my comment that I'm overusing. You know, they chose this actress. They chose a very, very beautiful, well, at least I think she's probably bleach blonde. But the other thing, though, is this. We've all probably met mean girls that are incredibly beautiful and then use that, use cruelty as one of their tools in their box. So, you know, it's Regina George all over again.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question is when you see this character, how are you reacting to her? And the reality is she's also in a subordinate position and is attempting to claw her way up. Mind you, she's going to step on Atticus and the entire family to get up there. But, you know, this is kind of one of the realities of our socially stratified society that demands this type of behavior.
Mm-hmm. And also, too, if you think about it, you know, what they did to Yahima, what they did with another character that they kind of just, Jiang, what they did to Jiang is kind of like everybody's kind of using everybody else that they have slightly more status than. You know, this person is, you know, this person is intersex. Oh, this person is an immigrant. This person is, so I can take from them and then use them and then I can get mine. And then this other person is not even viewed as a person. They're just viewed as a symbol for, and she's using these people, these black people, as a symbol. But they've used people as symbols also within the story. And again, I said, I don't like the whole idea that, oh, you know, if everybody had the opportunity, they would be horrible. If I had if I had Hitler's power, I wouldn't have done that. Like, that's not what I would have done. If I could have done slavery, I wouldn't have done slavery. So I don't necessarily like that argument that people make. But I mean, also too, like, to kind of go into real life, it's so weird. I was looking at your Facebook page, Jack, and one of your friends was talking about Topsy and Bopsy and put up a photo of them. And I really wanted to, like, go through the screen and, like, smack her, and I don't know why. I felt it was really... It was very bizarre to me. I almost feel like this show is an in-house show. Like, you're not going to get this show if you're not... I mean, you're white, and you're watching it, and you're enjoying it. But there's some parts of the show is, like, I feel like... If people are watching it without a full understanding of black culture, it can be a bit, I don't know. Do you feel as if, okay, amongst white people, I almost feel like this show is like a black show, even though it's not, it shouldn't be a black show, but I feel that it's like viewed as, oh, that's a black show. Amongst your white friends, what do you feel? Do you feel that people are into this show or?
I think they are. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that I'm happy to see is that people are starting to accept high quality products, regardless of it is. And not to go back to the 80s and relive that. But one of the public crises at that time was all of these white kids getting interested in rap. And if we turn back the musical clock and look at it, usually what would happen is you would have often an ethnic group. I'm going to say it mostly was coming from African American. So, you know, you'd occasionally get from Caribbeans and other groups. they would develop some music. The whites would then repackage it. So you, Elvis Presley, for example, is a perfect example.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a moral panic, too, or a public panic, that these kids were interested in this type of music. So I think that, is it seen as a black show? I don't know. I'm enjoying it as a show that's set within the African-American community. And it's also kind of interesting because it's bringing up a lot of topics that are left out of the white communities. So for me, I'm enjoying this. Are other people seeing this as a black show and, oh, I'm not going to watch it, or, oh, it's a black show, I'm going to watch it? I don't know. But right now, it is, it's more talked about than the other one that's in the background, Raised by Wolves. And that's done by, oh no, what's his name? Ridley Scott. When Ridley Scott does things, everyone that was really interested in science fiction and fantasy would be watching. But I'm hearing more chatter going on Lovecraft Country than Raised by Wolves. And think about this. When the Raised by Wolves stuff comes out, you and I are on it immediately. Not the Raised by, the Lovecraft Country. We're on it immediately. We still have 3 episodes to go on Raised by Wolves.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, it's, but like I said, I feel like we're both enjoying it a lot. I just like was taken aback, and it was weird because I didn't think I would be offended by it. I didn't think I would care that someone would kind of like put the topsy, you know, the topsy-bopsy. But it was something about it, how it was done, that made me offended. So I was kind of like, are they watching it and like making fun of us?
No,
or like
not? No,
okay,
not.
Well, if it, like I said, we don't know. I'm just, you know, and I think, you know, the thing is, you know, with this. Is, you know, I think another book that people should read in regards to this is Black Reconstruction in America by W.E.B. Du Bois, that's kind of been lost. And, you know, it really tells of an important period. I'm confused as to, I'm not really confused, but it disturbs me that they have tried to erase that 50 years after the enslavement of African Americans were over. They've tried to erase it. They've tried to take it out of, and they even tried to take periods of art and things and try to remove it to a different period. Like, Central Avenue, that's the Harlem Renaissance in Los Angeles, where I am from, Los Angeles. Central Avenue, the Harlem Renaissance, they're trying to make it seem as if those were things that had to do with Jim Crow or that had to do with oppression, and that our art has to do with oppression. And actually, that's not true. You know, you create better art when you have freedom to move and freedom to think. Being terrorized does not actually create great art. And I think that by putting, the high periods of black art into these incorrect periods, you are creating this idea that in order for black people to create art, they need to suffer.
Yeah.
I felt that the black arts had actually suffered a great deal under Jim Crow. And, you know, you just started seeing this really wonderful stuff kind of happen after the Civil Rights Movement. You started seeing these, you know, wonderful books, novels. I mean, Toni Morrison came out. I mean, Spike Lee came out. You had this activity after we were in, you know, freed from Jim Crow. And now I feel like we're slowly coming to a point where, you know, the death rates, the murder by cops is going up, not going down. Laws in regards to arrest rates, in regards to jailing, it's going up, not going down. College rates are dropping, not going up. So we went to this period where, you know, I'd almost say like, you know, 2010 was like this kind of peak. And now we're coming towards the end of it, and I hope people see that, you know, stress and hard does not make the best art. But, you know, let's kind of also go back into the story of, they go back to Tulsa, and I know you're very upset by this.
Okay, I've been in science fiction for a long time, and back in the old days, they would ask are you a Star Trek fan or a Star Wars fan? And at this point, you know, they start getting up and snapping their fingers like the Jets and the Sharks. And I was a Doctor Who fan. Why? For a variety of reasons, I enjoyed Doctor Who a lot more. Here you have our heroes. They don't have a time machine. They've got a TARDIS. Yes, this TARDIS is a fixed point in time, and some of you folks out there know what I've just referred to. They've got a TARDIS, and they send our heroes back to Tulsa. And we learn that just as in every other time travel movie, they change the past in certain ways. In this case, it's to rescue a very important book. But and here's where I'm going to really grump and gripe. They go back to the family. Most of the family is burned up in the house fire that occurred during this massacre. And when a house of that size burns down and people don't get out, they're lucky to find teeth. So those people were gone, gone, gone. They've got a TARDIS. They could have brought all the people in that house forward. And your criticism was is that, well, oh great, they're sending them to segregated Chicago. They could have sent them on the planet 504 to live Earth 504 to live out their existence in a world that, you know, we didn't think Hippolyta was going to come back from. So that was one of my first issues was, geez, you didn't pick that up as a potential. No, we're just going to grab the book, and maybe that's to allow the trauma and the tragedy to continue. But I have to say, if we were given a time machine or a TARDIS, I would be just going back to the dance, like in Peggy Sue Got Married, or something small. Use it. You've got something big,
I think,
and you've got other alternatives.
well, I think that's one of the challenges of this story. And I don't know if it's on purpose or it's done because, like I said, going back, to my comments in regards to homosexuality, LGBT community, and they're kind of this idea that it would be just a horror show if you within because they're in the black community. I wonder, is it because in so many in a lot of things, like so many time shows are like you're not supposed to touch anything.
Well,
But that
that's
the
go back to Ray Bradbury's The Sound of Thunder.
the yes. And the thing is that I feel that they're putting white rules on a black situation. There are people that, to me, I feel like if you aren't supposed to die because of this, this monster of racism, and you're gonna be dead, dead. I wouldn't have brought them back. When you see, that's the thing I thought about. Like, okay, Planet 504, that would be fine. I wouldn't have brought him back to Chicago because that's another thing. It's just funny. It's like people think the future will always be better, and that's something I always think is really funny. I would love to actually, if I were to have a time machine, I would love to go back at the age that I am now. I would love to go back to like 1890s Chicago, or maybe 18 no Massachusetts. I would like to go to Massachusetts in 1890. I know Boston is horrible, became horrible during Jim Crow, but if I'm the age that I am now, I'd be dead before that happened. I would go back to Massachusetts, Boston, Massachusetts in 1890. I might go back to Los Angeles in 1890. I don't necessarily think the future is always better. I think that we've lost some beautiful parts of our past. But I definitely would not have done. I wouldn't have just went back to Jim Crow, and I think that's the thing that scares me about the whole like, oh, if we go to the future, it'll be better, because I understand what happened when. The thing is that if you're W.E. Du Bois, and you're Trotter, the black radical, and you're out of Boston, and you came to 1955 Mississippi. I don't think you would even think that it would be that kind of a horror show happening. after you've gone to like, you know, gotten your PhD from Ivy League institutions, traveled all around the world, and, you know, Black international peace organizations where people from all over the, Black people from all over the world, like, would meet, you know, in this kind of glamorous ships or hotels, like in the early 1900s. There's no way you would, if you got into a time machine and came back to 1955 Mississippi or Chicago or even Boston, I think you'd be so disappointed in regards to what happened, or necessarily what went back. And I think that that's, you know.
If I can bring in two things here, Jella Biafra had a great monologue called Wake Up and Smell the Noise. And he talks about when he was a child growing up in the late 60s, early 70s, and getting ready for the punk scene. There is still this vision of the future as it was going to be bright. And somewhere around the 1970s, our visions of the future in space and even other things start to become a lot more dystopian. It's not that there weren't dystopian things before, like 1984, where things could go wrong in the future. But the overwhelming idea that the future was going to be difficult was something that wasn't common. We had this vision of a bright future, and you saw it in the movies. Heck, if you go to Disneyland, yes, they did have Main Street America where you could soak up the nostalgia of the of pre-World War I. But you also had Tomorrowland, and you had the race cars that kids could ride in around the track, and you had Space Mountain, and that was supposed to be your traveling to the future. It's all very exciting. But right now, dystopian visions of the future are hot and in, and the ones for the bright future seem to be a lot less common. And on some level, I think that what might be going on is people are looking around, they're seeing, hey, maybe things aren't getting better the way we had hoped. Yes, we've got more toys, but we don't have the advances that we thought we would have, and we're not in control. So what you get is a dystopian type, all I need to do is survive to the next sequel, instead of, hey, we're going to build this great society.
And I think that that's something that's really disappointing because, you know, you look at this, you know, and that's one thing I think I loved about this episode, before things first set on fire. You see how beautiful and calm everybody was.
They're getting ready for
They're
prom.
getting ready for prom. I mean, that's the thing too. You know, I remember
That
my.
was a neat little detail in here, was the whole prom at Booker T. Washington High School. And actually, that high school does ex still exist.
Yes, and I think that. You know, it's very weird because when I hear about my great grandfather who, you know, was in Los Angeles and he talked about, you know, his prom and doing things, and it's really bizarre because it almost felt like my great grandfather and my grandfather at times were more free than my mother, who's a baby boomer. And I think that that's something that. You know, I always kind of pointed out, I'm like, why does it seem like people, Black people, were more free before? And people are able to take that as, oh, well, because Jim Crow and we had to be by ourselves. And I'm like, that's not right because Los Angeles wasn't segregated. We weren't segregated like that. There were parts of Los Angeles that were segregated, but we were from the East Side and it was not segregated. Black people, Latinos, immigrants, all that kind of stuff. We were, you know, white immigrants. We were all together. So I'm it, it wasn't that. That wasn't the reason why. You know, my grandfather and my great grandfather had, you know, they had Asian friends, they had white friends, they had this is keep in mind it's in Los Angeles, so it's gonna be different than other parts of the country. So I'm very kind of yeah, so I got to see that. And you know, I don't know why. You know, like you said, the grandmother setting being set on fire and
Things we didn't need to see. Well,
Thanks.
and here's one other one. And I'm going to play a little clip from a parody of Doctor Who. Sorry about that. And this is from The Case of Fatal Death. This is Comedy Relief. And once again, they've got a time machine. And this Comedy Relief episode kind of gets to the heart of the potential. So.
No one has set foot on this planet for 100 years. You thought you had escaped my traps of death. But you forget, Doctor, I too have a TARDIS. When you told me to meet you at Castle Tursurus, I simply traveled back in time 100 years. And I bribed the architect. Say hello to the Spikes of Doom.
Say hello to the sofa of reasonable comfort. Naturally, I anticipated your journey back in time, and so I traveled slightly further back and bribed the architect first.
So, you've got a time machine. This is not fixed. There's a whole lot of things they could have done, and this is where I have to admit some frustration. And I'm not going to be frustrated at the story or the actors. I'm frustrated with the writers. You have a TARDIS, literally a TARDIS, and you're wasting it. Is it so that you can keep this a total tragedy and not make light of it? I don't know. You know, on some level, letting people die when you could actually save them is really, really frustrating. And I'm thinking of Dr. Albert Schweitzer, who, when he asked why he does things and how he could save an entire continent. And yes, Albert Schweitzer was one of these white colonists that went to Africa. But he says, you know, think of a beach. It's covered with pebbles. And you can't save them all in one handful. So you grab some and you grab more. And every time you visit the beach, you grab more pebbles, and eventually you save the beach, or you at least cart it away to make a rock garden. The point that I'm trying to make is that they've got a time machine. You know, that family doesn't need to die. They know how to operate this thing right now. They could literally go from house to house and take them off to Earth 504, and where they would, instead of this whole discussion of the problem with Chicago, segregated Chicago, is that it's maybe a step back. Well, Hippolyta liked it so much she stayed there for 200 years. And and they could too. So, did they want to keep this a tragedy to keep the horror? Maybe that was the case. But, dude, go back and bribe the architect. Or at least in the case of Montrose's boyfriend who gets shot. Remember, Montrose, a bucket. Remember a bucket. And then you drop it on the killer's head. Just like in Bill and Ted.
Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, there are some challenging things in this show, just because, you know, it was so close to, I mean, actually, I said I had relatives that were killed in East Texas.
In a similar event,
in a hotel in East Texas, not my mother's side of the family. We were all my mother's family, her father's side and her mother's side were all from Louisiana. Her father's family went from Louisiana to Los Angeles immediately. They just went straight to LA. My mother's mother's family stopped off at Texas. And then had to flee for their lives after the city caught on fire and went to Los Angeles in the 1919 or something like that, after they set my great-great-great aunt's house on fire, hotel on fire. So this was, you know, for me, it was very depressing. And, you know, especially too when I used to hear things about, you know, the hotel that they used to have, et cetera, et cetera. And I used, you know, it's funny because I didn't know if all the stuff that they talked about was necessarily true. And then I, you know, I did some of that genealogy thing and I found out, like they said, you know, how she died, fire. And I was, at that point, I was really kind of like, oh, all that stuff was true.
Sorry.
Yeah. I hope you don't have the COVID.
Oh, it's the allergies. We've been discussing this. We've been having a cool and moist fall. And as a result, you get a lot of spores produced by the happy fungi. And those are causing me to cough and things like that.
Yeah, okay. We'll go with that. We'll go with that Milwaukee person. We'll go with that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I mean, that's essentially, you know, do you have anything else to add, Jack?
Oh. Yeah, long uncomfortable pause. There are certain things that I really, really liked about it. And as I said, there's I think potential was missed from the standpoint of giving hope. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens in the finale. Because once again, you've got a time machine. And the Christina doesn't seem to be using it at all. Lastly, there's this whole issue of she's going to go for immortality. So, as you know, she's going to require all of his blood. But even at this age, they're doing blood transfusions, and he's got a whole lot of family around. The idea that Christina's going to suck it all down like a vampire. Hello, Charles Drew had done all sorts of blood transfusions, and this was, at this point, a common practice. You know, this. I hope that the writers are not going to hamstring this. They're not going to realize that there are alternatives. And once you have magic involved, once you have machines that can do time travel involved, they've got a lot of tools. Christina can get her immortality without having to kill people. And
I'm hoping you'll show an Easter egg of Charles Drew at mm-hmm. some point. That would be pretty cool to have him be part of that. He would be old enough to do it.
The first mobile blood collecting unit was February 1941. So this was a common practice at this point. We're in the 1950s.
This
is a common practice.
Yeah.
So here's the big question. You know, oh, they need all his blood. Well, he's got all his family nearby. Everyone can donate a pint. And everyone walks out. She gets her immortality, and we have a second season.
But
we're not the writers.
We're not the writers, so, yeah, we're just the podcasters. But, go ahead.
Nope.
Yeah, okay, so that is up. That's the end of our show. This is Tika.
This is Jack.
Yeah, so hope to see you guys next week.
For the great finale.
Yeah, we're looking forward to that. It's going to be exciting. Mm-hmm.
And we'll probably watch Raised by Wolves sometime by then and finish Riverdale.